Good evening, everybody, and welcome along once again to the Buddhist Society of Western Australia at our Dharmaloka Centre here in Perth, Western Australia. And we're coming up to do now the second part of the Vaisak ceremony for this year, 2020. And of course, as those of you that were with us this morning will know that we have here a very empty hall. But nonetheless, I think that for those that saw this morning's ceremony will agree that it was a very, very moving and very emotional kind of a ceremony. So it was, very, very successful. And we hope that this afternoon's live broadcast will do the same for you. I'd like to just introduce Venerable Hasapanya, or Ajahn Hasapanna, who has joined us for this afternoon's events, and along with Ajahn Brahm, who you saw this morning, of course. They will be, in a moment, having a Dharma discussion. Both of them will be able to answer any questions that you want to write in, so you're very welcome now to write in questions, and they will answer any of those questions that you might have during the period between 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock here in Western Australian Standard Time. Well, 3 to 4.30, so we're giving over quite a bit of time to allow you to ask questions. Then from 4.30 to 5.30, we're going to do a circumambulation. And we're very lucky, in fact, to have a lot of our AV team here today who've put in a lot of time setting up cameras and so on so that we can sort of follow this event as the group. In fact, there'll be four people that will circumambulate this afternoon. There's the four pillars of Buddhism, if you like. We'll have Ajahn Brahm representing the Sangha, the male Sangha, monks. Venerable Hasapanna will be representing the nuns, the order of nuns, Sangha, and the lay men, the third pillar of lay men, and then the fourth pillar of lay women will be all represented here this afternoon in the circumambulation. So that's between 4.30 and 5 o'clock. And then between 5 and 5.30, we're going to be reading out and welcoming new Buddhists. And indeed, the number have gone up this morning. I reported that we had 77 people that had applied to made it known that they wished to become formal Buddhists, if you like, coming out as Buddhists. But I think that number has climbed, and I'm not really quite sure where we are to now, but it's sort of well and truly over about 80, 84 people or something like that. So we'll see how many people there are that want to be named by the time we get to 5 o'clock this afternoon. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over now to Ajahn Brahm for this afternoon's proceedings, who'll lead the Dharma discussion for today.
Excellent. So thank you, Dennis. Long-serving president and vice president and fulfilling so many roles for our Buddhist society for so many years. It's wonderful to see you here. And also, again, a good welcome to Venerable Hasapanya, who's come from Dharmasala for today as well. To give it some sort of equity, not just seeing the monks all the time, the males, to see the females as well, the fully ordained bhikkhunis, which is wonderful to see. And so for today, we're inviting questions. This is from the very earliest part of Buddhism, where the Buddha said it's not just listening to the Dhamma, listening to people give the teachings, but it's also having the opportunity to ask questions. And any questions, if it's something which doesn't make sense, we'll let you know. But we'll try our very best to answer the question as honestly and as straightforwardly as we can. Now, when you ask these questions online, it would be helpful if you have a preference to say, this question is for I, Hasapanya, or this question is for Ajahn Brahm, or this question is for both of you, because that makes it easier for us to know which one the question is aimed for. So, are there any questions yet online? I think it takes a while, that the internet is very slow. It's easier to transmit the information online, But then to read the question and then to ask the monks or the nuns is quite difficult. So anyway, I will start off. I can ask a question of Ayahasapanya. We haven't seen you for a while. How are you? And how are all the bhikkhunis at Dhammasara?
We are fine. Still in one piece.
Still in one piece. But is that piece thin or is it very fat?
No, because they are a bit busy because of preparing for the, you know, on the raining season, some of the work you need to do, like painting, we have to paint before the raining season comes. But they're happy because we only work in the morning, and afternoon they'll go back to meditate. So there's a bit of balance, like they have work. They feel quite fulfilling that they're doing something, you know, being of service, and then that actually they arouse a lot of happiness in them when they go back to sit after dana. So then there is a bit of balance with work and meditation.
And are you getting enough dana? Enough people bringing food to feed you?
Yes, they have plenty. They have a lot. I have to keep telling people not to bring anymore because they have no place to store.
No place to store. There is one good place where you can store food, and that's in the nuns' tummies. But you can only store so much there. So anyway, have we got some questions already?
Yeah, Jen Brahm, maybe I could just ask a question. I would like, if both Sister Ajahn Hasapanna and yourself, if you could maybe just expand on just what this COVID-19 might mean for the world. Do you think that this has an opportunity for us to maybe change our ways? I mean, just for myself, I've noticed that that this last 4 or 5 weeks where we've all been in lockdown, I mean, it was a bit traumatic for a start, but you get the feeling that people are settling a little bit more, just maybe becoming more used to it. And I kind of notice here in Perth, just the air is perhaps a little bit fresher where there's not so many cars, and we know that there's not so many aeroplanes in the sky. Do you think there's an opportunity here at all for us to maybe have a different take on the world, maybe not to have ourselves so driven as what we were heading to, especially with all our bushfires and things like that?
Yes, so do you want to answer that first of all, or shall I answer it?
You can answer.
Okay, then you should have ladies first.
Okay. To me, it depends on how you look at it, because I got an article about in China. It's the first time they had clear skies, you know. And that's sometimes you look at it, it's not really a bad thing, you know what I mean? Then actually people slow down and stop, you know. And it's been, you know, been very busy, and it's lots of pollution. But now, you know, they slow down, they start to see clear sky, blue sky. They never have blue sky at all. And also sometimes also make us really hit us, you know, that, you know, any of us, none of us would think that this will happen, isn't it? We can predict that earthquake, we predict flood, we predict fire, isn't it? This thing, none of us. Because what we project in the future that is going to happen is always based on our past experience of what we know, isn't it? Anything that we don't know, we don't project in the future that will happen. So that's why it's really, you know, it's really good to wake us up that actually we cannot control anything will happen. And no one knows. Who knows what's going to happen next? So actually all we have to know this moment. So actually, you know, and this might really help to really, you know, to waken up people that, you know, that they are not really in control, and we truly don't know what's going to happen next. And it's not up to us, and we don't know. And also maybe it's also helped to arouse the sense of urgency to really to look at it, you know, and to really, you know, to really penetrate, you know, the Dhamma and look at it's impermanent and just it's out of control, it's not under our control. And especially this COVID-19. I don't think none of us would think that, you know, happened. This is the first restart that we have it in the empty hall. I've been coming here almost 20 years. We have the same program, do the same old thing again, you know, the same old program again and again. But this year is the first. I find that to me, it's something new, you know. It's, you know, a little bit of excitement because, you know, but in the past, the same old thing. But at least this year, a little bit different. And, you know, you bring that a bit of freshness, you know, and at least something new. I think, that's all I can say.
Then I'm just done. Thank you. This is excellent because it does give you the opportunity to adapt. And, you know, human beings, whether we're monks, we're nuns, lay people, we have to adapt to the different things which come up in life and to show that we can adapt. And, of course, one of the couple of really nice things which happen is that people are less argumentative. I think I see much more harmony in our world because we have to. We have to work together in any crises or difficulty. And it's a shame when you have crises and difficulties to have to work together. And, of course, those give up opportunities. And, you know, one of the opportunities which I'm really happy with is that, you know, all those, some of my monks have been giving these talks every day. And some of these monks, I've never been able to get them to give talks before. And, you know, because, well, we have to serve, you know, the community which feed us and to show that, you know, we're still there for them as they're always there for us, bringing food to us every day. And to be able to serve them is a wonderful gift. And also to see just how even young monks, they rise to the occasion, they come and just do some simple talks. Nothing much is expected of them, but they always seem to surpass those expectations, just as many people do. It seems to be that when there are crises, it could somehow bring out the best in people, and they can just do that little bit extra to actually to make this a much better world. And also just the extra time which we have as monks and nuns to be able to spend time meditating and practicing our Dhamma in order to get stronger wisdom and compassion and stillness. All those things are there. So whatever happens in our world, there's always opportunities. And even if things go very, very difficult for anybody, just like, you know, I did get quite a few emails from people who were literally just on the cold face of the COVID crisis. There were doctors in places like Spain and Italy, who, you know, listen in to the Buddhist Society of West Australia YouTube talks, and they were just saying just, you know, how supportive the BSWA was, and how when they had these incredibly difficult decisions to make, they had to choose who would live and who would die. Almost literally. Terrible decisions to have to make. But nevertheless, to get the support. So they found a way of doing it. They were put in the most difficult situations, but rose to the occasion. Which is one of the reasons why it was wonderful to see that people clapping and cheering and applauding our health services, who when it's needed, go that extra distance out of compassion for the world. And those are the things which are very moving. They are the new type of hero, someone said. And it's lovely to see heroes who don't use violence, but use kindness, wisdom, science, to make for a better world. So many beautiful signs. Let's hope we don't forget those signs and those examples when this is all over. Anyway, thank you, Dennis, for that question. And it just gets the questions rolling. At the end of this session, I'm sure there won't be enough time to finish all the questions. It's just at the beginning. It's hard to get the questions coming up. There are no questions?
Yeah, so we got a question for Ajahn Brahm here. Is phenomena, rupa, created by the mind or merely observed by the mind?
The phenomena called rupa, basically it's stuff. Is it created by the mind? According to theoretical physics, a mind is needed for it to exist. We're talking about sort of the quantum theory of Schrodinger's interpretation. I'm not quite sure if this is relevant for a talk on Waysack Day, but it's part of the world, so why not? That the Schrodinger interpretation of quantum reality is that there's a mix of probabilities. Life not as we really understand it. Life as we can't really conceive it. But when we make an observation, when we do an act of knowing, which needs a mind to do that, then, out of all the probabilities, one happens, and that is the world as we know it, once we've known it. The world isn't something out there which is the same whether we see it or we don't see it. That old philosophical question, a tree falls in a forest, and or does it fall because no one's there to see it? Has a tree fallen? Has a tree not fallen? And quantum theory says, well, it hasn't fallen, and it hasn't not fallen. It's neither. And so someone checks it out, and the mind gets involved. And so because of that, I'm not quite sure if that's the meaning of your question, but in science, the mind is needed. Knowledge, consciousness, especially to create matter. Otherwise, does matter exist? It's a very interesting, an interesting idea. What it does, it just starts to make you extend your understanding of this world. Instead of being something which is, as our Venerable Ajahn Hasopani said, is predictable, something we know and can rely upon. Reality can be a little bit different than that. So, I would say yes, it does create, but not just create, it interprets as well. So, this world, it's how we interpret it, is a lot of times influences how it grows and how it develops to an extent much more than people expect. So that's an interesting question. Would you like to add anything to that?
I think it's a bit better question. I don't know whether it's, you know, for example, like a thing that exists and you pay attention to it. If you don't look at it, it's not exist. For example, I have a clock, you know. In my clock, it actually is very like tick-tick-tick. But if I do pay attention, it doesn't exist. I don't hear it at all, you know. But sometimes I pay attention, it's really loud, you know. So the psych, I don't know what it actually means, that things will not exist when, you know. If you have the contact, you pay attention, things exist. And if you don't pay attention, things will not exist. So I don't quite get the question.
Yeah. Well, if the question was not answered to the question of satisfaction, please ask it again with a little bit more information.
Okay, next question here. This is for Ajahn Hasopani. Can you kindly discuss how it has helped you in the path being a fully ordained bhikkhuni? Sorry about that.
Bhikkhuni, yes. Yes, when I first joined Dhammasana, and we are only like we are 10 precepts now, so we haven't got this higher ordination. And actually, at the beginning, I don't really. I felt that it's okay, you know, as long as I live in the monastery, you know, practicing, and it doesn't matter if I'm not a bhikkhuni, you know, and it's fine with me, you know. And I think that it's okay that I can just practice as a 10 precept nuns. But actually, really, things change and really wake me up, and there is a shift. When I was in Malaysia, because last when at Dhammasara, even those who are 10 precept nuns, we try to keep all the people in the rules, so we don't eat food, we don't take food that is not offered. So for example, we have no anagarikas, so then we have no breakfast. So we only wait for the people to come to offer us food. But actually, as a 10 precept nun, actually you can, you know, take food. But the way we practice, we try to keep control. So I'm used to that with a few years that we've been doing that. And that is like part of my life. I naturally don't take things that is not offered. even though I'm only 10 precepts. So when I went back to Malaysia, I remember I was there staying in one of the monasteries. And then it's naturally, I just had, you know, it's just part of me, it's just a habit, you know. And, oh, it's not offered, then I didn't take. And I remember and this monk told me that actually, yeah, only 10 precepts, actually, you don't have to be offered, you know. Then I realized that, you know, and actually, if you be 10 precepts, you try to keep all these rules, people think that I'm making a fast, you know. But you only 10 precepts, you only summon Mary, what's a fast like, you know, you try to keep all these rules. Actually, I find that it's not supportive. And also, deep down, also, I'm aware that some of the rules that actually being 10 precepts, I'm not really breaking it. Do you know what I mean? And then when you become bhikkhuni, it's different. You have to confess, you know? And actually, it truly helps you, you know? It helps you to refine your behavior and your conduct. Actually, you're working on a more refined defilement. Like most of those, like, rules like pachiti and things, actually it's not immoral by itself, but actually it helps you to support us, you know, to develop our mindfulness, to be more aware of, more mindful of that. And also, very easily we just, you know, out of habit, whatever we do, sometimes we can be very mindless, you know, but because with all the bhikkhu rules actually help us to develop our mindfulness, become more aware of, you know, what we are doing. And because very easily we fall back to like householder habit, you know, that it's out of habit. And it takes years to really have the sense of monastic. So when people newly come to monastic life, they've forgotten their monastic, you know, very easily you fall back. But before the rules, actually that reminds you, and also that partly that also helps us to develop, establish our mindfulness, we become more aware of, you know, we are relying on the generosity of the lay people, we are unthinking, and it's actually all this, it's reminding of Ajahn Chah said, actually, sometimes people don't get enlightened because of that, they're too terrible thing. Actually, you look around, hardly you see people that doing terrible things, isn't it? But only the small things really hold us back. All the underlying tendency, all that little craving, all the little things, you know. So we tend to just say, oh, it's okay, it's fine, you know. And all these underlying tendency, that's really keep us in the samsara, keep coming back. That it's very difficult because this is a very refined type of defilement. It's not the gross type of defilement. Nothing wrong, you have to be a craving for food and things like that. It's not that it's bad, it's not that it's moral, you know what I mean? And most of the, like most of the rules itself, you know, like the Pachitya rules, it's not that it's moral by itself, but actually it helps you to refine, you know, to refine your behavior, and it helps you to establish and develop your mindfulness and become more aware of that. And many of the nuns also give me the feedback that they feel the difference. Initially, everybody thinks that, oh, just being a, you know, it's okay to be summonary, it's okay to be just keeping them except. They see the difference. Because if you become more aware and helps you to develop your, whatever you do, you know, and then you, oh, this I have to confess. But as a summonary, you don't have to confess. As a bhikkhuni, whatever, you know, all the slightest thing, you know, you become more aware of your behavior, your intention, your underlying tendency, and all this actually help us to work on a more refined defilement, you know. And that's what I find that's a different. Until you become a bhikkhuni, you know that it's a different when you are keeping them set and you are bhikkhuni. So I hope this makes sense to that person and to answer this person's questions. So anything, gentlemen, you want to say?
No, because I'm not a bhikkhuni. That is true, that there's a high level of renunciation where you have to give up. And that really assists you. People expect more of you. It's not one gets into being guilty if one makes mistakes. It's just when you do make a mistake, you always acknowledge and you admit it. You ask for a confession, which is you're just telling it to another monk or a nun. And then say, okay, please don't do it again, that's all. No punishment. It's just when you tell somebody else, it reminds you of what your commitments are in this life. And it was there as a vehicle which was made by the Buddha. And so there was a purpose why the Buddha established the Bhikkhuni Sangha, as well as the Bhikkhu Sangha, with all of the restraints and the rules and the freedoms as well. And those reasons you learn little by little the longer you are a monk or a nun or bhikkhuni. And then as you learn those, you respect the great wisdom of the Buddha. There's more letting go, more renunciation, more opportunities for service as well. And those are just beautiful opportunities which you have if you're a fully ordained bhikkhuni or a bhikkhu, but you don't have if you're just the novice. So again, the only way you can really know those is when you live them. Not through theory, but through experience. And you find out, you know, this is my 46th year as a bhikkhu, and it's a wonderful opportunity, and something which I look back upon as being so incredibly fortunate to be in these full robes of a fully ordained monk, and to realize some of the great profound benefits which the Buddha saw. I never saw those when I first became a monk, but really realized those in my later years. So it's a beautiful thing to be experienced, known, and then so valued.
Okay, next question here. This is for Ajahn Brahm. Can a lay person attain liberation without having to enter the monastic life?
The full liberation is basically no. And if anyone was very angry at that, that shows you're still a long way from liberation. One's reactions are really important to show, you know, where one is in life. But what is actually said by the Buddha was fascinating for me, something I never understood when I was a young monk. So if a lay person does get the full realization, I'm talking about here arahat, fully liberated, with no greed, no hatred, no delusion, fully understanding the Dhamma, then basically the reason for you to continue living as a lay person is not there. Basically the will to live, to continue on, has stopped. Unless one can be, at the very least, a field of merit for others, a source of teachings and Dhamma, to be able to ordain. So the tradition was that if a person, a lay person, does become fully enlightened, an arahat, then because of the deep peace and stillness and contentment inside, the only place where they belong will be in the monastery, will be as a renunciant. Renunciant because their mind is already renounced with their attainment. There's nothing more which they can keep or attach to in this world. So they become a renunciant, live in a spiritual community of monks or nuns, out of compassion, respect, faith in the Buddha. That's why the Buddha set up these monasteries for, so that the monks, the nuns, could teach either through words or by example, as a field of merit for the world. So, yes, in a sense, they can become fully enlightened, but they have to ordain pretty quickly, or they'll pass away pretty quickly. They will die and just disappear into Nibbana. But it's very difficult for a lay person, I'm just being honest here, very difficult for a lay person to get fully enlightened simply because of all the impediments, attachments, and the difficulties of that life. I know, because I was a layperson before, many years ago, I can still remember. And it was like, can it be done? Yes, it can be done. In the same way I answer that, can you walk from Perth to Sydney? Yes, you can do it. But there are things like cars, buses, trains, even better, aircraft. If those aircraft are there to transport you, a layperson, from Perth to Sydney, why not take it? In this simile, yes, I can sort of see it may be just about possible that a layperson can get fully enlightened. But why walk when there's aircraft you can travel in? The Sangha, developed by the Buddha, with all of the requirements of solitude, living just in peaceful places, not being too involved in the world, not being able to have money, TVs and stuff like that. That's possible. It makes it so much easier. So why would a person want to do it the hard way? So that's the answer to that question. I know that in these days I've seen that many lay people, I just can't understand just how they have anyone take them seriously. Lay people who say they're fully enlightened, and to me as I respect the lay community, nuns community, fellow monks, different traditions, but to say that lay person is enlightened the way they do, there's no way. That, you know, your idea of what enlightenment is very, very strange. It's certainly not the way the Buddha described it. And that's all I can say.
Okay, next question. This question is for Ajahn Brahm. Is progression on this path depending on our practice and commitment, or does it have more to do with our karma?
Obviously that karma has a part to play. If a person just has, you know, sort of a very healthy body, a lot of freedoms in this world, they're born in a good country, manage to get reasonable education, and has the freedom actually to listen to Buddha's teachings, and the ability to practice those teachings. In some places one cannot do that. So little by little, you know, we find that karma does have a positive influence. It makes it easier. But nevertheless, it's much more than karma. Sometimes there's, except for very, very strong bad karma, what is called in the Buddhism the antarika karma, which is, you know, things like, you know, having murdered your father or mother or something. Except for those, there's no karma which cannot be overcome, and you can become fully enlightened. So, and that is because of your practice. And sometimes the practice is not so much, as I'm well known for these sort of statements, not so much because of your effort, really going for it. It's more to do with your wisdom. To be able to understand what the Buddha was saying, and to find that it's not a path which is driven by your personal ego of wanting to attain and trying to get where you want to be. It's through something much different. It's not just the intellectual knowledge, which is important, but it's not crucial. It's for that which is not what you learn from books, or what you gain from an inspiring teacher. The reading between the lines, realizing if this is a path which culminates in the sense of ego vanishing and disappearing and eventually not just being there anymore, then it cannot be achieved through the ego, through a sense of self, through me wanting something. Which means that we try another way. Another way of kindfulness, if you like, of being kind, being aware. It's not trying to get somewhere else. It's learning how to be here. And not being critical of this moment. But open the door of your heart to this very moment, whether it's painful or pleasant, or anywhere in between. Making peace with it. When you do things like that, your sense of self and control start to disappear. You find it's that wisdom which defeats the defilements. The ability to let go is not achieved by willpower. It's only ever achieved through wisdom power, through understanding, rather than the usual word, the usual meaning of the word effort. It's a practice. It's a practice of letting go, renouncing kindness and gentleness. That's the path, in my understanding. Why, Hasapani, do you want to add anything to that?
I just want to share with you one of my friends. And we used to practice together in early days, you know, when as the lay person, we go on retreat together. Sometimes we have Dhamma discussion. And then she'd be able to recollect her past life. And she remember one life that she's been a monk with Ajahn Mun. And she practiced very hard. And she said, I want to get out of it. I want to enlighten this life. I want to get out of the suffering, you know. And I remember when I go with her for, you know, with a retreat, she get up really early. And then when she has slot and topper, she hit herself on the wall to keep herself awake. And then she practiced so hard until that she got really sick. Very sick. And then I noticed that she's craving not to be. You know, there's another craving not to get enlightened. There's like lots of people that say, oh, I don't want to be reborn. I say, it's not up to you. You know, you need to reborn. You know, there's craving, and I can see her that she craves not to be reborn. She craves it. She wants to get enlightened. And even someone practice, like, even someone can recall, like, the past life, I think it's just the wisdom that comes, isn't it, Ajahn Brahm? That just see. And then she just, I want. I want to get out. I want to get enlightened. And even she can recollect her past life. And she said, oh, I have enough. I want to end this life. I want to get enlightened. And then the harder she tried, the worse, until the point that she was having, maybe she was so sick that she had a terrible headache because she tried too hard. And she wants to get enlightened. And actually, craving not to be is still craving, and most people don't see that. And I keep telling people, you know, you don't want to reborn, actually, it's still one thing. One thing not to reborn is still one thing. Most people don't see that the one thing is still there.
Very good.
Next question. This is for both Ajahns. A friend said some unkind things to me yesterday, and we had a difficult conversation which has left me feeling angry and sad. How can I let go and be kind to us both?
Okay, one way, is that the only thing your friend ever says to you, unkind things? Or is that the only thing we remember? You'll probably notice that your friend, the reason they are your friend, you've had such wonderful experiences together over all that time you've known one another. And many times you've said some kind, very pleasant things. But those kind and pleasant experiences we have, for some reason as human beings, we forget them. And when something bad happens, we overly focus on the faults. And of course, I think you all know where this is coming to next. The two bad bricks in my wall. 998, a few thousand beautiful bricks which I laid, and there's two mistakes, and that's all I could see. And I know what happens when you focus on the negative part of what you've been doing. The two bad bricks were just so, I was so obsessed with them, so disappointed. I even thought they spoiled the whole wall. The two unkind things your friend said, spoiling your relationship. No. I wanted to destroy that wall. I was so fortunate that we couldn't afford it. And so eventually, that wonderful person, I don't know who it was, such a long time ago, said to me, yes, the two bad bricks are there, but the 998 beautiful bricks are there also. It allowed me to see much more of what was troubling me, my mistakes. I saw the big picture, the whole story. And when I saw the whole story, it wasn't a bad wall anymore. And it's the same with your friend. You had an argument and said some terrible things to one another. There's much more going on than just that. And when you see the whole, the big picture, then you'll find that, yeah, they said some wrong things. But that doesn't destroy the relationship. In fact, those two bad bricks are still there. What our builder said, which you must also remember, I've said it so many times because it's so relevant. They said the two bad bricks make it a feature. The builder told me that. He said, the builder who was recovering from cancer, he said, and the two bad bricks in the wall are a feature. And if you're a builder, you always charge your client an extra few thousand dollars for it because it's unique. The only house in the city which is like that. And I kind of celebrate that answer. Yes, a person says some nasty things, but they also say some beautiful things as well. Remember the beautiful things. You say some nasty things sometimes. It doesn't make you a bad person. It's a good person who said bad things sometimes. That's all. So please forgive the mistakes in life. I understand you make those mistakes as well. Learn from the mistakes and try not to make those mistakes again. Little by little we grow. And those friends, when they see just how wise, how tolerant, how gentle, how even when they say nasty things, you can still make peace, be kind and be gentle. They really respect you, especially if you're a Buddhist. So that's my little answer to that question. Do you want to say anything, Ajahn?
Yes, for me, if someone said nasty things to me, I said, oh, thank you for giving me the opportunity to practice forgiveness. And sometimes I reflect on that when people speak, said nasty things to me. Sometimes I reflect, I sometimes ask myself, you know, am I ever said nasty thing to others, you know? So sometimes we do say nasty thing to others, isn't it? So that's why, you know, sometimes we feel terrible when we say nasty thing afterwards. We feel, you know, we feel terrible, we don't feel good about ourselves, you know? And then I reflect on that. I know that person also suffer because the person will beat themselves up, feel terrible about themselves, why I said this thing. Because sometimes they cannot sometimes you just can't control yourself, and then it's so quick that, you know, come back at your tongue, you say something. And then after, I remember one of the things I remember I said to my father, I feel terrible, I feel so bad. That time I was still a lay person. Then my father said to me, I know, each time I tell you things like that, you won't listen. And then that's why, then you know what I answered him? I said, since you know that I'm not going to listen to what you said, why you want to talk to me? I was quite rebellious, I can honestly speaking, when I was young, I was really rebellious, you know. And as I grew up, I truly think that it's really very bad. I shouldn't say that to my father, it's really. But we all do silly things before, isn't it? So we just, you know, get on with life, forgive and let go, you know, forgive ourselves. And then sometimes people say nasty things, oh, thank you for giving me the opportunity to practice forgiveness, compassion, you know. Forgive, you know. Thank you. These are great opportunities. I can practice forgiveness. So I think this is one.
Very
I
good.
Hope it makes sense to the
person. Okay, the next question is for Ajahn Hasapanya. How do some kids remember their past lives? Is it when they have a sudden death?
You mean the person?
Yeah, I think it's referring to the child. Oh. How does the child remember their previous life?
No. She's a true meditation. When she meditate, and then she go in the deep meditation, and then after coming up from the deep, after the deep meditation, she be able to go back to recollect her previous life. And she see once of her life that she's been a disciple of Ajahn Mun. And even some people have this deep meditation, but I think the wisdom faculty is not there. And she's got the nature. She's always like that. Even when I first know her, she always like that. She do walking meditation, she will walk on those stones that are quite sharp to keep her awake. Like, she's very, very diligent. She practices very diligently. But I think it's too much willpower. And I remember whenever he talked to the monks, all the teacher would tell her, relax, relax, relax. And she said, I relax. But I think she's too tight. So, you know, she's too much willpower. I think because of she had that experience, then she want more. And then actually getting worse. The one thing actually because of those experience that she has, you know, she had before, and that maybe, you know, trigger her craving that she wants more, and the one thing, you know, one thing to get enlightened, you know. And I think the wisdom faculties is just the wisdom is not there. Yeah, true meditation actually is not from childhood.
Okay, next question. This one's for Ajahn Brahm. How can we not dwell on the past and focus on the present?
Oh, it's this. How can we not dwell on the past? I look at the past and I can't change anything of it. It'd be wonderful if I always trying to find out the mobile phone number of Doctor Who, which apparently is still alive. And I go in this time machine and fix up all the problems of the past. But of course, that's only fantasy. That's a BBC TV series, Doctor Who. But nevertheless, you can't fix up the past. The past is gone and it's finished. And I find that I add to the past, even with as much honesty as I possibly can have. Every time I remember the past, I'm really remembering the last time I remembered it. So every memory of the past is distorted slightly. Just like in that little game when you have a line of school children and you tell the first children a message and they whisper it to the next child or whispers it to the next child. When you get to the end of the line, the message is totally different than the message which you began with. And that's how memory works. There's another type of memory, though, which is just not using your brain, but using your mind. And that is the type of meditation memories which Ajahn Mahasapanya was referring to. In very deep meditation, sometimes you can just connect with a very early memory from your past, maybe your previous life. But that is more like re-experiencing the memory. It's like if you remember, say, a meal you had, you can taste the flavors. The information is far clearer and more sort of reliable. And that type of memory is more interesting because that is more truthful. For those of you who know the theory behind this, it's a mind memory, not a brain memory. And this is only happens when you are free from what we call the five hindrances. The fifth hindrance is called doubt. And the amazing thing about these memories which you have, usually at the end of a deep meditation, is they're clear. And you know that what you remembered was truthful, it was real. And you can check it out afterwards. And it is valid. So that is a different type of memory. Those memories you can find like previous lives if you wish. For those people who still doubt the existence of the previous lives and rebirth, you can figure it out, find it out for yourself. Not figure it out, that was the wrong word. But you can know it for yourself. And also, you realize that
it still has limitations. The best wisdom comes from the present moment. The past, this lifetime, what is it, over 68 years now? There's a lot of memories out there, 68 years. But you've let go of most of them. You let go of them because it's too burdensome. Things which can't change. You've forgiven the times when you hurt somebody or they hurt you. You've let that go. And you don't learn from the past. There's too much of it and it's too uncertain. I realized many years ago, you learn so much more from the present moment. That is where wisdom grows. And the present moment is far more enjoyable than the past. And after a while of training in meditation, mindfulness and kindness to your awareness of this present moment, this present moment becomes a friend to you. Always there. Sorry, I should say always here. In other words, a place where you can relax and be at peace and be healthy. Where you can sleep well at night. Where you can meditate easily. Where you can enjoy other people's company. And when they pass, you can let them go easily. Because you're in the present moment much more. There's so many amazing benefits. Even now in the time of COVID, when people die, you still see people just feeling emotional. They don't know how to let go. But once you learn about the present moment and let go of the past, it's much easier. Much easier to face this moment and learn that this moment is where your future is made. So much training, so much encouragement to don't think of the past, but to learn from the present. This is where the action of life is. Life as it's happening. Live. Real. Not some memory which is distorted by what you want to believe. Or you want to think happened. Rather than what actually happened. So after a while, especially if you tune in to websites like this, and you listen to many of the talks of the monks, the nuns, you'll find that after a while that you'll come much more into the present moment. And your past will be less important. And you'll become much wiser, kinder, and more peaceful.
Okay, next question. This is for both Ajahns. Is keeping the five precepts in the daily meditation practice enough to attain stream entry in this life?
As a lay person, yes. I mean, during Buddha's time, lay people, they attain the first stage of enlightenment, keeping the five precepts, and it's possible. And one of the very famous is Isakka, and she's a stream meaner. She's a lay person, and she really, she had many children and grandchildren. And I don't remember. She had many. I've forgotten how many grandchildren and grandchildren she had. And and she's a great supporter of the Buddha. And she's a stream. Venus, and she's able to attain the first six of enlightenment as a lay person keeping five precepts.
Okay, this just very recently, a few days ago, that the Buddhist Society in Victoria are holding their Vaisak ceremony today, the same day. Obviously, they're 2 hours ahead of us. And they asked me, can you please give a talk, which was recorded, and I think it was played this morning sometime. And the topic of the talk for the Buddhist Society of Victoria was how to become a stream winner. And what actually is stream winning? And I made a point there. There is
There are two parts to being a stream winner. The first stage of enlightenment is those on the path to being a stream winner and those who have actually attained to that stream winning experience, which is a penetrating to non-self, to realize there's nothing in here. Which is a very difficult, even many monks, senior monks, still have not made that penetration yet. But nevertheless, the first stage of being on the path was one out of faith or out of wisdom. But many, many people, such as those people who were hired to assassinate the Buddha in the story, I won't go into length in that story, you can find that out later on. But they came to the Buddha and the Buddha talked to them, and they just could not bring themselves to kill a person of the qualities of a Buddha, the kindness, the peace, the wisdom. They melted in front of him, figuratively speaking. And they got faith, inspiration from the Buddha. And afterwards they went away and they were called stream winners afterwards. But for me it must have been, they'd entered the path. And one who's entered the path, by the end of this life, they have to attain the fruition. Because this is a discussion which many monks have these days. How much do you need to be one who's attained the fruit of being a stream winner? And to me the five precepts are important, but not enough. You need the whole Eightfold Path. Especially, please excuse me that people think I'm a jhana freak, but I still say that the jhanas are also important, at least one of them. To be able to see beyond the illusion of an identity of self. And the simile which I've given, which is, I believe, is in the Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond book, the tadpole simile. A tadpole can never know what water is. Even if it's a good tadpole, lived all its life in water. But if a tadpole grows into a frog and jumps outside the lake, when the water has vanished, it's no longer there, then can understand what water is. Only when so many parts, what we identify as being us, ourself, our personality, and me, when much of that disappears, which it does in jhanas, when those things vanish, then you understand this body, the will, even consciousness cannot be you. Shocking but true. So you came to being a stream winner. And from there, once that right view has been established, as the practice happens of making that insight so strong inside of you, it's always there. So it means that the old views, the bad habits from previously, get worn out, and the new understanding becomes all that's left. You become once returner, non-returner, then fully enlightened. But I still cannot, it may be a fault in me, I'm not sure, but I cannot perceive how a person can break through to be attained to stream winning without the jhanas. And of course at the end of a person's life, when their five senses are taken away from you, whether you want to or not, when you die, there, if you have faith and enough understanding of the Buddha's teachings, then that jhana will happen at the end of your life. You'll attain to the fruit of stream winning. So anyway, that's my take on that.
Okay, next question. Thank you to both Ajahns for conducting this session. Really appreciate your kindness to share. May I know how one can apply the qualities of the four Brahma Viharas into our daily life?
Okay, who's going first this time? Do you want to go first or should I go?
Yes, sometimes you can. I just speak on through my own experience. Sometimes, like, I used to do that in my early days, that breakfast time, I try to bring out that qualities, you know, like for example, like metta, and this is how when I say that, see, if I find myself that I'm lacking of metta, normally morning eating my breakfast, I'll bring out that metta. I will recollect, I reflect, you know, when I eat the food that the first, you know, the first mouth I put into my mouth, I reflect on the food and how all the beings contribute in this food and things like that. Have the kind of really gratitude towards all the beings contribute into this food and all the effort that people have put in, and deliberately bring that kind of metta, you know, the arouse in myself, you know, and then have that, you know, even every morning I do that. To arouse that quality, and actually you can do it. You can develop that through your daily life. You know, even with your breakfast, eating your breakfast, you can bring that. Like I find myself like I have lack of gratitude, so I have a brain that gratitude. Like I have a brain that person in mind, and this is how you. Is this what Ajahn Brahm used to say? You condition, you brainwash yourself. You condition yourself. You keep telling yourself you brainwash yourself. Actually, it's really helped. That you naturally have that, you know. You know, it's like one of the saying that, you know, you fake it until you make it, you know. I find it's really useful, like, you know, when I lack of those quality. I truly, when I sit there every morning, have my breakfast, even now I still do that. I recollect, you know, the food that I have ate. You know, I stay for a little while, I recollect, and I do reflection on that. Actually, that truly helps. And also sometimes also every day, the first thing in the morning when I get up, I always, you know, sometimes I just reflect on that and thinking of what I can do, what can I help, rather what I can give today, rather than thinking of what I can take. And this is not to underestimate this. This is how that you develop the habit and become part of you. And naturally, that you it becomes a habit. It's like part of you. And actually, you can do it through your daily life. This is just my sharing.
Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, it's very, very similar. That every time that there's a lot of the kindness, the gentleness, the giving, the equanimity as well, the contentment, the stillness. A lot of that is just natural because you've been brainwashing yourself or been brainwashed by others to do that for such a long time now. But every now and again, sort of you can find unique ways of loving kindness. That's why we're here today, to talk to an empty room. We're talking because it's kindness. And it's just why, just all those monks that Bodhinyana Monastery, we have a roster now of monks to give talks down there. They're enjoying it. They find it's a service which they can give. I don't know what the quality is, but it's not really important, the fact they're actually doing it and giving it and being kind and showing that little bit extra. That's metta in practice to people who look after them. That's you. Those who send the donations, who come with the food, who are always really trying to find out, are the monks and the nuns, are they well fed? I mean, it really is always. I've been a monk for such a long time now, and it's still just, impresses me. Surprise impresses me that people come from such a long way, and they find out what the monks or the nuns need to eat. And they come and give it in abundance. It's embarrassing sometimes to see how much food is given to us, even today. I'm here by myself for lunch. Ayahasapanya was at Dharmasara. And how many, I think there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 shepherd's pies for me. That's crazy. I can't eat that much, but people thought I would like it, and they gave me all those shepherd's pies, and it was beautiful to see. For me it was inspirational that people were practicing their loving kindness, and I was practicing my loving kindness back as much as I possibly could. But of course I make sure I don't eat too much,
Otherwise, that's not being loving kindness to my bone body. And the other thing which of those Brahma Viharas, that one of the Brahma Viharas which is, you know, people often forget, you know, the mudita. This is where we rejoice in other people's success and goodness. When somebody else, you know, sitting next to you answers a question so much better than I could. Sadhu, 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 ayasapanya. Sadhu, sadhu to people who do it better than you. Sadhu, 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 it's rejoicing in other people's goodness and kindness. And that creates just this beautiful energy in the world. So we don't get jealous. We just see the goodness in others. And we rejoice in it. And the idea of her ego, who's the best, just disappears. We don't see who's the best, we just see the goodness in the world and beautiful people. And that causes me so much happiness. When you see just one of the monks who I live with, the Bodhinyana Monastery, doing that little bit extra. Yeah, well done. Oh, maybe I should have done that first, but no. It was great that you did that. Well done. And it's a totally different attitude to what that one sees in the world. An attitude of great joy and great happiness. Mudita. Brilliant. Okay, I better stop.
Okay, next question. This is from Penang, Malaysia. And for either Ajahn. Why do we circumambulate around the Buddha statue? What is the reason behind it?
Why we circumambulate? We always circumambulate keeping our right side to the object we were respecting. And it's just one of those old ways that we would, before COVID, would shake hands. The old days that, in UK anyway, we'd ride our horses on the left side of the road, you know, just so that, you know, you can, most people being right-handed, they could defend themselves. But anyway, that this was just a sign of respect. You had an open shoulder. I still got sort of, you know, the robe only on half the shoulder, but because it was been cold the last few days, I've got the warm axle on. But often you see me with a cold shoulder. Cold shoulder, I should have said bare shoulder. But this is where we get the saying from, to give a person a cold shoulder. But no, that's always on the right hand side. The sign of vulnerability, openness, not hiding anything. And that's a way of paying respect to something. There's so many ways we can pay respect, but going round that statue three times, it's time of just reflection, of not dominating the thing you're worshipping, but treating it with kindness, with respect. And you see that, that's even how the Muslim community does the same circumambulation around the Hajj in Mecca. And people have been doing this in Indian communities, walking around three times. And this is a way of respect. And it was wonderful to see in those years when Ajahn Chah was still alive, being in Wat Pa Phong, that sometimes you would see sort of army helicopters. They would fly over Wat Pa Phong, but they wouldn't fly straight over. They'd go around three times in the air, and I saw this myself. Army helicopters circumambulating Wat Pa Phong when Ajahn Chah was still alive in that monastery. Their way of respect. So we're not going to circumambulate in helicopters today. Just a quiet walking around, keeping our right side to the object of respect. And remembering the qualities, and if you like, our debt of gratitude to the Buddha who taught so well. Would you like to add anything to that?
Yes, normally when we do that, we recollect and reflect on the Buddha, the qualities of the Buddhas, and the teaching of the Buddhas and the Sanghas, that after listening to the Buddha's teaching, and they also get enlightenment with those qualities. Actually, that's helped to inspire us as well. And that's why when we recollect and we reflect on that, actually, we also develop those qualities. So it's not, it's a sign of, it's a it symbolizes that the respect of, the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. And also, it's also helped us to develop mindfulness and also those quality, and also gives us the faith, and the inspiration is really inspire us, and also develop that qualities, and also we remind ourselves that we ourselves also have that potential, have the qualities too. You know, we also be able to develop those qualities, and it's good that we remind ourselves and to inspire ourselves, and it's important to have that faith in ourselves, to have the confidence in oneself. And actually, it's not only just we when you look at us, we are not only just the Buddha Rupa. Actually, at the same time, actually while we're doing that, we develop those qualities.
Very good.
Okay, next question here. What are your thoughts? This is for either Ajahn. What are your thoughts on dry vipassana practice to enter stream entry?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Sorry. What are your thoughts on dry vipassana practice to enter stream entry?
Dry
vipassana.
Drive past. I don't understand the question. Maybe you answer it first of all, if you understood it.
I don't really. Is it to bypass the stream entries? Like we bypass?
Yeah, I think they're asking, can you enter Sotapanna or stream entry without jhana? I think that's what the question is.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because I've made that point.
Yes.
And it's one of those things which people argue with me, and I still maintain that I cannot understand how a person can actually to penetrate and overcome what's called Sakaya Ditti. And Sakaya Ditti is when you take any of the five khandhas, the five components of existence, as a self or containing a self or self within there, or just as a self, and as a permanent essence. And I don't know how a person can do that. I can't see the means without the jhanas. But nevertheless, the jhanas certainly make it much easier. And it's also, if you have let go of so much, the jhanas should be easy. Not a problem. So first of all, yes, I reckon the jhanas are necessary. People always like to try and shortcuts. But my experience in life, whenever people take me on a shortcut, it always takes more time, if it actually gets to the destination at all. And sometimes I think, no, these deep stages of letting go, deep stages of abandonment, of renunciation, they're a sign that you're on the path, or past that path of streaming. It's just what they feel like means that this is part of it, it's part of the path, an essential part of the Eightfold Path, the jhanas. And that's the Gopakambhogalana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, when just after the Buddha passed away, when Ananda was, I called him like the go-to person. And then somebody asked Ananda, this was recorded in the Majjhima Nikaya. Majjhima Nikaya, Gopakambhogalana Sutta. And there said, well, when a person, what type of meditation did the Buddha recommend? What did the Buddha actually teach? Ananda said the Buddha only recommended four types of meditation. It's only meditation he taught, four types.
first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's it. It's powerful. I don't know, do you want to add or take that away from that?
Because first means three meanings, that actually you don't have the identity view, then you have to have to see non-self. So in order to see non-self, that's actually with the five influences is still there. You still confused, how can you see non-self? So the anatta actually is the key. So a lot of people say, I don't want to come back. If you don't see non-self, you're still coming back, you still the sense of self is still there, I still want to be here, you know. Even though yes, I mean theoretically you say yes, we don't want to come back. But you can't help it, you still have to come back because you don't see non-self. So when the five influences is not there, when it disappears, and it replaced by the five jhana factors. You know, when the five hindrances, you overcome that, you know, when that suppress or disappear, and this is replaced by the five jhana factors. So there's like, in order to attain stream venus, so first of all, you'll be able to see non-self. But in order to see non-self, then that five hindrances cannot be there. If the five hindrances is there, your mind is still your mind is still clouded, you know, you're still hindered by that, you know, the five hindrances, you're unable to see non-self. So I think that's
very good.
Answer that question.
And jhanas aren't that hard if one is committed.
This question is for Ajahn Brahm. How can we measure our progress in our meditative life? I have read about reaching jhanas, but are there any milestones before that?
No, if you're looking for milestones, you're blocking the path to jhanas. All those stones on the road will block you. So don't have any milestones. Just have the amount of peace, the amount of stillness, the amount of kindness. And just see how much you can let go, and not to measure. Even little things, there's different ways of looking at this, and that's what I mentioned, it was just a throwaway line, but very powerful just a few moments ago. The jhanas aren't that hard for those who are committed. Committed to what? Committed to not measuring, to letting go. And sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, you're going a bit too far here, when I start quoting core Mahayana teachings. The verses of the third Zen patriarch. The path is easy for those who have no preferences. I love that little saying. You don't measure. You don't measure how far you've got or how far you have to go. When you don't measure, you can't control. There was that question someone asked me such a long time ago. The neurons of physicists, before I became a monk, I was probably still am. But they asked me just what I thought of that saying of the philosopher Lord Kelvin, that the only way to control nature is to learn how to measure her accurately first. Which meant that a lot of effort was put by scientists into getting accurate measures of time, distance, weight and many other things. Because once those qualities could be measured and tested, then we could control nature. It was called technology. But then they asked me what I thought of that, and of course you turn it around to be more in line with the third Zen patriarch. I said, when you don't measure, you can't control. When you don't measure your practice, you can't control it. Which means, in other words, you let go. And then the path happens very fast. Because the obstacles you're taking away. Let other people judge where you're at. Let other people see how kind you are. See how peaceful you are, how wise you are. Let other people do that. You just stop measuring. Anyway.
Okay, dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you. You always make me laugh. I am and have been going through a lot of suffering over the last 3 years. Is this because of my karma?
Oh, who knows? Don't blame your karma. When you suffer, we always want to blame somebody. Sometimes you blame the government, you blame your partner in life, you blame your parents, you blame the job, you blame the stars are not in the right alignment, and now you blame poor old karma. Oh, your poor old karma always gets some hammering. So don't blame anyone. You're going through some suffering in life. Learn from it. And don't blame it. Suffering becomes your teacher. Again, a wonderful little teaching from Ajahn Chah. He said, whenever there's a difficulty in your life, he told me, such as mosquitoes. And most mosquitoes, they were just so incredibly intense in the jungles of northeast Thailand. 40, 50, 60 of you in one go, and you could not get rid of them. It's so incredibly irritating. And when I complained to Ajahn Chah, he said, no, that suffering is your teacher. Always remember to call those mosquitoes Ajahn, mosquito. Whatever difficulty and suffering you have, make use of it. Like the Emperor's Three Questions meditation, now is the only time you ever have in the world. And the thing you're experiencing right now is the most important thing in the whole world. Even if it's very unpleasant, this is called mindfulness. Even if it's an unpleasant experience, not what you wanted, painful. If it's happening, there's no escape. Be with it. Be kind. The last of the Emperor's Three Questions meditation. Care for this. It's amazing how even unpleasant, painful feelings, when you care for them, they lose their... It's like the snake loses its venom. It's just like the pain loses its sting. That what was sometimes almost unendurable is now just a small irritation. Because what you're doing, realizing this great teaching of the two arrows, the emotional arrow and the physical arrow, both cause you pain. Physical arrow you can't do much about. We get sick, we get COVID, we get old. But the mental arrow is in full power to remove that. And that is 95%, 98% of the problem. That is why I'm telling a joke when somebody is suffering. Just telling a funny story. That helps. That helps take away some of the difficulty. Just like that story I saw the other day of this Italian man. The Italian man told his partner that he was going to make a bicycle out of spaghetti. And his wife thought he was crazy until she actually saw him with her own eyes riding past her. Riding past her. Okay. Very good. Do you want to come up with a silly joke or something serious? Or next question, it's up to you. Oh, next question. Okay, next question.
This question is for Ajahn Asapanya. Is there any difference for meditation when you are a woman?
Can you repeat the question? Huh? Female. Mm-hmm. Oh, I think there is a lot of wonderful things being a female, you know. And I remember early days, when I meditate, and I always make the aspiration that next life I'm not going to become a female, and it's so difficult being a female, you know, it's terrible, you know. And I used to do that a lot. And one day I really I was really waking up, you know, because I walked out that day, you know, I'm going to the town to get tickets back to Malaysia. I was in Thailand. Then when I walked out, just outside the monastery, then I saw a group of men. They are gambling and drinking beer. Then I look at them and I started to ask myself, they're so close to the monastery, you know. So I asked myself, what's the point of being a man if a male, like, I don't have the opportunity to practice the Dharma, to listen to the Dharma. So then I realized that it's not about whether, you know, whether I like it or not, I cannot change the fact that I'm being a female. So, but I started to see lots of benefits, you know, being a female, because, like, for example, in Thailand, you know, monks are always, like, you know, I know the lay people treat the monks like gods, you know, they're always bow, you know, so we're always, like, you know, but actually, I spoke to some of the monks, they said to me, actually, sometimes make them feel truly, because sometimes you know that the way the how the lay people look up to you, sometimes also give them a lot of pressure as well. Mm. And for me, I don't have that pressure. It's okay, you know. And then I find that, and also as a female, I can just, you know, if I feel like I'm crying, I just can cry, you know. And, you know, and it can be emotion, it can be, you know, you can cry, you know. And I find that it's fine, you know. But as a male, you have to be always, you know, tough, you know. You have to show that you're tough. You cannot cry and things like that. And I started to see a lot of benefit being a female, you know. I can cry, you know. Yeah. I can be nobody. I can just, you know, people don't know me, you know. And then I just, you know, hiding at the back, you know. And no one going to really bow to me and look up to me. And I don't have that pressure. And I find that it's most important thing that I have to, I reflect on that. I have the opportunity to listen to Dhamma. Mm. I have the opportunity to practice. So it's already very good to me that I must have done lots of good things in my previous life in order to deserve this. So I look at this, I have done lots of good things, you know, in order to deserve this. So that's why since then, I never make that expression anymore. I said it doesn't matter whether I'm female or male. As long as I have the opportunities to practice, to listen to the Dharma, it's really good. You know, so it doesn't matter now to me.
Do we have time for one more question here? Okay, this is for Ajahn Brahm. You spoke about Waisak being a day for us to show gratitude to the Buddha.
Right.
Can you share more on this?
Ooh. Sometimes that we reflect on today, it's not just the birth, it's the enlightenment and the final passing away and just all that went in between. It's a Buddha day. And when I reflect on just how the Buddha has changed my whole path of existence, and the amount of debt and gratitude you have to this incredible teacher, the wisdom, the teaching, recording that teaching. And I was telling some of the monks, I was having a discussion with Ajahn Bamali just a couple of times in the last couple of weeks about some of the deeper teachings about, you know, what happens when a single jhana anagami comes out but doesn't get reborn again, enters parinibbana straight away. It's a very powerful, very deep teachings. And it's how difficult it is to find the correct words for this. Because these are states which have very little to do with the world in which we live here, but are real. And then you go into those suttas, the teachings of the Buddha, which I was fortunate enough to be able to read in the original Pali. I had to do Latin when I was at school, my age, in good school. And then Latin is not that different from Pali. And then being able to read those teachings in Pali and understand the words, how the Buddha described these things, and be really dumbstruck, so impressed with the Buddha's ability with language not only the attainments, or the, you know, the letting go rather, but the ability to describe it in a way which even me, sort of a Westerner, could get a handle on, and how difficult it is, you know, for sometimes Westerners to describe these things. But the Buddha did it so perfectly. That's why in the reflections of the Dhamma we say, first of all, Sawakata Bhagavata Dhamma, just how well explained are those teachings. Such difficult things to put into words. And the Buddha did such an incredible, wonderful job on that. And that just, even now when I say that, that just makes me get the goosebumps again. Just so much gratitude. So much things which you say, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you deeply for. You know, it's one of those things you have if ever you do crack, just to use a Western word, to become a full stream winner. You just want to bow, 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 bow to a Buddha out of gratitude. Even, oh, what was that? Please don't ever do this to me. One person did this once. I was in Thailand, in a monastery over in Thailand, and this monk came up, American monk. As soon as he saw me, he said, you probably don't know who I am, but that doesn't mind. And he bowed to my feet and started kissing me on my feet. He was a monk. And I said, what on earth are you doing? And he told me that I was the first person who taught him meditation. He had so much gratitude. It just was natural. And I remember the first time I got a deep meditation, that's what I wanted to do to my teacher. You get so much feeling of they've given you so much. They're giving you freedom. A path out of samsara. Great, great teachings. And you feel so much gratitude. And so I'm an old monk now, but I still remember those emotions. And on Vesak Day, I like to express those emotions to the Lord Buddha. Great teachings. Great life. Was the one who gave full ordination to bhikkhunis. Wow, such an incredible thinker. Or Noah, that could do such things. And so, this is my opportunity of saying thank you for that gratitude. As each one of us, there's people in your life, people you've known, maybe never seen, but just heard them on YouTube or whatever. And the gift of Dhamma which they've given you is so priceless. You can't sort of give a donation to pay that off, it's just, that'd be billions. But it's just the kindness, you want to do something. As they say, to pay it forward, to do an act of kindness, to share it, to spread it, so the gift of the Dhamma never ends. They always say, and this is just drummed into me over the last month, that they call it the reproduction rate of COVID-19. If it's above one, then it would just take over the health system. If it's below one, then it's going to die out. Maybe slowly, but it's under control. And so may the reproductive rate of the Dhamma be above one, so that this Dhamma can spread and spread and spread, and so take over much of the world with kindness and gentleness and peace and giving. With all those beautiful qualities which inspire us, qualities which remind me why I'm here today, paying respect and gratitude to the Buddha on Vesak Day.
So Anjana, I would like to take this opportunity to express my gratitude for all your supports and also your supports and also the Bhikkhu Sangha. And without your support and the Bhikkhu Sangha support, I don't think it's possible to have a Bhikkhuni community in person.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
And please don't kiss my feet though, you get
No.
My feet. Oh, very good. Oh, thank you for that. And of course, thank you for all of our Buddhist society here, BSWA, and all the people in our committees, supporters, for so many years who supported the Bhikkhuni ordination here and supported putting all these talks on YouTube, supported having sanghas and retreat centres, sharing it over the world. It's not just one person, it's just the whole community and all those overseas as well. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu to you all.
Sadhu, sadhu.
Okay, so that's the Q&A. I'm not quite sure how you felt that was, but no judging, it's finished for today. There'll be many opportunities to ask questions afterwards, another time, another place. But now we're going to try something we've never done before, just have a small circumambulation around the Buddha statue outside. It will be filmed. And as I was taught by Ajahn Chah, the first time around I'll remember silently the Buddha. The second time to reflect on all the Dhamma which I've heard and learned and seen. And the last time around the Sangha. It's my offerings out of gratitude, out of respect to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. The Sangha of both genders, and the whole Buddhist community as well. And may they all flourish, live a long time for the benefit and happiness of all beings. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So I'm now going to bow three times. Are you okay just to do it straight away?
Yes.
You don't need to go to the toilet or anything. Good. So I'm going to bow three times to the statue in front of me. Then we do have some candles here, although it's... You don't really need the candles because it's just the late evening, 4:30. But anyway, we're going to do that anyway. And you're happy to just feel your presence with the Sangha, the jewel Sangha here, and join in recollecting the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And once we've finished at 5 o'clock, that is when that I'll be giving the Three Refuges and the Five Precepts to the new Buddhists internationally. So please don't go anywhere yet for those who are waiting for this. That'll be happening at 5 o'clock. I'll give those precepts, I'll read out your names afterwards and welcome you to the wonderful Buddhist community. Okay.
To go. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We've come now to the last part of our live streaming episode here today, and we're going to now name and give the five precepts and the three refuges to all of the new Buddhists that are putting their hands up today to call themselves Buddhists. So we're going to be doing that over the next half an hour or so. Ajahn Brahm has the list of people here, and I think there's quite a few of them. But just before we do that, I did want to just make a special note to thank Lucky. Lucky is a lady that's on our committee, and she has organised this little event. And I wanted to very much express my appreciation to her for doing that. And also Nick, our caretaker, our wonderful caretaker, who... has helped with the administration of this. I just noticed too that in the hall before we had Lynn. Lynn is our matriarch of the Buddhist Society here. She's been around here right from the very beginning. She's a female caretaker that lives on the site here. And just like to acknowledge her too. And also just the whole of the AV team that's here at the back again. We've got Martin, our manager now, our new manager, and of course Jake, who oversees a lot of this and has made today quite special with introducing new cameras and making sure that the sound and that was as good as it could be. But also those dulcet tones you were hearing in the background, they come from Alan, who is also a member of our AV team. And I think that he is a Canadian man. He's just giving me the thumbs up to say that that's right. I know that he's been here for a couple of years or so, but probably about a year or so on the AV team now, so very, very nice to have him here today to help out with this. So, and also, Sister Hasapana was driven here today by Anagarika Buwa. I should have mentioned her name before earlier on, but we're very grateful to her to be able to bring Ajahn Hasapana up from the Dharmasara Monastery. So, just with those few words, I'll hand over to Ajahn Brahm, and I think he's going to ask me to do something. I've just got to go and find what I need to do, and I'll hand over to Ajahn Brahm now.
Excellent. So, there's a number of people who are going to be asking and taking the three refuges and the five precepts today. I have a whole list of their certificates here with their names on, and also signed behind. I'm not sure if you can zoom into this, whether the AV people can do this. This is the first one, just happens to be on the front, for Mr. Bushy Hunter. And I've got a signature on the bottom there. And you will know it's my signature because they have something special on the first letter, which... it's not a joke, it shows it really is Ajahn Brahm's signature. A smiley face. Can you get that? Excellent. That's just an example. Good. So those are on all these certificates, which Lucky will send out afterwards. It's amazing what she does. But anyway, that these are for the people who are using the occasion of Vaisakh, the holiest day of the Buddhist year, and they're using this to take the three refuges and the five precepts for the first time. And you will find these, especially the three refuges, Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, Dhammang Saranang Gacchami, Sanghang Saranang Gacchami. It's almost they define Buddhists of all traditions. If any of you have the privilege to go to a place like Bodh Gaya, you'll hear that chant resounding in the evening. Buddhang Saranang Gacchami. And again, gives you the goosebumps moment. And those are the three refuges which I'll be chanting, and the people online will be chanting afterwards. And you should have the pieces of paper there which tells you what to do. By the beginning of the taking of refuges and the five precepts usually begins with somebody asking for them. And because the people I'm going to be giving the three refuges and five precepts to are overseas, I've asked Dennis, on your behalf, to formally ask for the three refuges and the five precepts. Dennis.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. And I have respectfully asked Ajahn Brahm if I can do this in English as well, so
yes, that's good.
At least you will be able to understand that and not my my bad Pali. Venerable Sir, we request the three refuges and the eight precepts.
Five precepts.
Venerable Sir, we request the five precepts and the three refuges.
You get three types.
For the second time, Venerable Sir, we request the five refuges and the three precepts and the eight and the five. Venerable Sir, we request the three refuges and the five precepts.
Yes.
Venerable Sir, for the third time, we request the five precepts and the three refuges.
That's good, yes. Thank you, Dennis. It has been a very long day for poor Dennis. He's been working very hard. And the three refuges and the five precepts. And it's also wonderful that when we do make a mistake in Buddhism, instead of criticizing somebody or fault-finding or telling them off, we just find out how funny it is. I learned that from Ajahn Chah, my teacher. When I made a stupid mistake, he would find it so funny.
just that story of when I had to go to him to ask for any requisites I needed, and I needed some soap. And the pile, the Thai word for soap was sabu. I said sabo. And that actually means pineapple. So I thought I was asking for soap, but I'd asked my master, my teacher, for some pineapple. And being very kind, he asked me, he said, "What do you want pineapple for?" And I said, "To wash." And he almost fell off his chair laughing. He never let me forget that, telling that, oh, in England, they wash with pineapples, and they're far more advanced. We only wash with soap in Thailand. But it was a wonderful little funny story. So when we do make mistakes, if you do the pronunciation wrong, that's not important. The fact that you are taking these precepts and you mean them, that is what is important. So I begin, I will say the Namo Tassa three times, which is the homage to the Buddha, the Noble and Perfect, the Enlightened One. Then I will pause and be silent, and I'll ask you in your own words, either in English or in Pali, whichever you prefer, to also do the homage to the Buddha three times, after I have finished. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Please say the Namo Tassa, or homage to the Buddha, three times. Now we chant the three refuges. We do those three times. I'll say them one at a time. When I finish the first one, please, you repeat it in Pali or in English, whichever you prefer. Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dhammang saranang gacchami. Sanghang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. that completes the three Buddhist refuges, which is common to all Buddhist traditions, showing one's commitment for refuge as a resource for safety, for wisdom, for inspiration to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Almost defines you as being a Buddhist. And now for the five precepts. For those of you who do not know what those five precepts are, the first precept is to refrain from intentionally killing living beings. Living beings which can be seen. So bacteria, viruses like COVID-19. That is not breaking a precept to actually to overcome that virus by whatever works. These are visible beings. Second precept is not to take what is not given to you, not to steal. And that even means, please excuse me for this, even means like filling out your tax returns accurately. Not cheating. It doesn't matter if everybody else does it. Buddhists don't do it. We're honest. We don't steal. And the third precept is not committing sexual misconduct. In particular, not adultery, not sexual abuse, not using your position as a teacher, as someone in authority, to demand sexual favors and abuse others. And especially if you are committed in a relationship, to keep within that relationship so your partner can trust you. And the fourth precept is to refrain from lying. There may be times you say something, you find out afterwards it was wrong. But that's not deliberately lying. That's just making a mistake. Just like when I said that I used pineapple to wash. That was just a mistake. So the intentional deliberate lying is we refrain from. And lastly, we refrain from taking alcohol, even small amounts. Because they used to say the drink, you take a drink, then the drink takes the drink, then the drink takes the person. So it's a danger. So it's much better to have non-alcoholic beverages. And that means you are safe. And the same with non-medicinal drugs. Drugs which you take just for recreation, for highs, because they may feel like they're pleasant for you, but they end up sort of distorting your cognitive process. You can't be as mindful, as clear as you were before when it's not done for medicinal reasons only, from a doctor. So, those are the five precepts. I will now recite them. Again, I will recite them in Pali because that means so much more to me. But you do have the translations there, so you can always chant it after I finish in Pali or in English. Panatipata viramani sikkhapadang samadhiyami. Adinadana viramani sikkhapadang samadhiyami. Kamesu micchacara viramani sikkhapadang samadhiyami. Musawada viramani sikkhapadang samadhiyami. Sura Vajapamadatana Viramani Sikapadang Samadhyami. Those are the five Buddhist precepts. You try to refrain, which doesn't mean to stop. The fact you break a precept, you feel that you're terrible. No, these are training precepts. If you do break a precept, you try and find out why. You learn from the mistake and you make sure you don't do it again as best you possibly can. These are guidelines for our life which we try and keep as best we can. Not to deliberately kill living beings. Not to steal. Not to do sexual misconduct like adultery or sexual abuse. Not to lie. Not to take alcoholic drinks or non-medicinal drugs, which take away one's awareness, the ability to know what's going on around you. So those of you who may have said it not quite correct when you were repeating it, you may have maybe not finished it, and I was too fast for you, but it doesn't matter. You come here in front of your computer, listening, trying your best to determine those five precepts. You have taken them. You've determined them. So now I give you the blessing of those who have taken the five precepts. Imani panchasikapadani silena sukhating yanti silena bhoga sampada silena nivritting yanti tasma silang visodaye. These five precepts, they lead to a happy abiding. They lead to the accumulation of good things, even physical things. You don't waste stuff. And they lead to even Nibbana. Therefore, please, to the best of your ability, please keep these precepts pure as something very valuable to you. And also, because you've taken those three refuges and five precepts, you can formally call yourself a Buddhist without any. It doesn't have to be forever. If you find out you change your views and ideas later on, you can always change if you wish to. This is only not compulsory. It's not a cult. This is freely chosen to live your life by a set of virtuous principles of harmlessness and peace and goodness for your happiness and the happiness of all that you meet. Now I was going to read out the names of those who have taken the three refuges and five precepts today. And there's another one that's come in already.
Correction for the first one.
Oh, okay. Oh, Bishi Hunter, not Bushy. Actually, I prefer Bushy Hunter. It's a nice name. Doesn't matter. So, these ones are, and if it's made any mistakes, please let Lucky know, and we can always amend these before we send them to you. To Bishi Hunter, I don't know which one, in Melbourne. To Heidi Remmer in UK, to Ingrid Seward in Albany, Australia, in Josiane Gatt in Malta, Joanne McKinley, don't know exactly where she is, in Nick Julian in Tennessee, hi y'all in Tennessee, sorry that was a terrible sort of accent, but one of my really good friends I grew up with was from Tennessee. He was a Rhodes Scholar, and you know, he used to make some amazing peanut butter and say amazing sort of southern accents. He was from Tennessee. Anyway, to Nick Julian, welcome. To Tracy Marker in Massachusetts. To Cho Ma Wu, it is in Perth. For U.A. Kamani Gunasena, who's in the Northern Territory. To Shanika Fernando in Cairnley, Victoria. Nuwan Gomez, who's also in Cairnley, Victoria. Patana Taiwanit, from Patonthani in Thailand. Lisa Wesselu in Parkerville, West Australia. Helen Cook in West Haven, New South Wales, that's Helen Cook. Matthew Ronald Jessett in Dianella, here in West Australia. Luisa Figueiredo Salzano in Porto Alegre in Brazil. So you're listening to this. Oh, it's probably so early in the morning, so amazing if you're listening to this. Well done. To Steve Johnson from Murdoch in West Australia. To Tilini Madigaspe in Neutral Bay in New South Wales, Tilini. Ben McDougall in Neutral Bay, New South Wales. Marie Menere in Lennox Head, New South Wales. Anna Liam in California, USA. Jenny Gleason from Bunbury in West Australia. May Traveller in Singapore. Darren Swan in Padbury, here in West Australia. Bernadette Lee in Gosford, New South Wales. Katarzyna Kolomiczek, please I apologize if I pronounce that incorrectly, that's from Poland. Katarzyna. Jutta Szyszkowski from Leipzig in Germany. Nadia Schurman from Switzerland. Emily Henderson from Texas, USA. Joe College from Torquay in UK. Carolina Lauber in Poland. Oh, you've got two Carolina Laubers here. There's a bit of a mistake there. Or maybe you can have two certificates, why not? Orla Smythe from Northern Ireland. Shay Min Pei from Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. Irene Pedrera from Spain. Karina McKillen, McKinnell from Brisbane. Fionn Ichard from Hong Kong. Sharon Boxall from 2J in Western Australia. Peter Walter Jerk, who's down here. Peter Walter Jerk from Singapore. Sally Byrne from Albany, West Australia. Sally Ann Elizabeth Blakers from Albany, West Australia. Tracy Callison from Ohio in USA. Dorothea Manke from Tokyo in Japan. Adam Crossley from Malham in North Yorkshire, UK. Leo Bosine from Deer Park in Victoria, Australia. Sonia Dietrich from Unna in Germany. Marco Turtinek from Germany. Li Ching from Singapore. Beto Iliff from Minnesota, USA. Erin Dunn from Fort Worth in Texas, USA. Augustia from Wellington, New Zealand. Catherine Hewitt from Paris in France. Bianca Falk from Wuppertal in Germany. Kenneth Whitman from UK. Tracy Callison from Springfield, Ohio, USA. Heiko Falk from Wuppertal in Germany. Gemma Chandon from Corkfield, Victoria, Australia. Holly Durbin from Seattle, USA. Reese LeBlanc from the USA. Gerd Buss from Muscat in Oman. Maria Guadalupe Suarez from Asturias in Spain. Hilaria Pompey from Germany. Anne Hollenbaugh from California, USA. Caitlin Willits from Dalyellup, Bunbury, West Australia. Feni Tandra from Indonesia. Irina Lee from Sydney, Australia. Daniel Rasaya from Sydney, Australia. Benedict Dasala from Vancouver in Canada. Dushayanti Samarasinghe from Hamilton in New Zealand. Shaunak Guharoy from India. Anna Sianda from Brentwood, Essex, UK. Claire Fowler from Melbourne, Australia. Alan Brown from Ayrshire in Scotland. Octaviani from Pontianak City in Indonesia. Kelly Bams from Northern Territory, Australia. Rachel Carr from Bedforddale, West Australia. Yen Lai Ngo from Singapore. Alona Krikova from Sweden. Phuong An from Vietnam. Diani from Toronto in Canada. Ricardo Venturi from Paris in France. And last but not least, Michael Vaccaro, New South Wales in Australia. For all of you, that some of you, when I read your names, I know you, I've met you before, and I know who you are. And so I see you on my travels. Some of you I may have never seen before, but who knows, one day we may meet face to face. But in the meantime, we meet online in these talks, in these events, in these services which the Buddhist Society of West Australia gives. And so these little forms, certificates, will be sent to you as soon as possible, and hopefully they will come sooner rather than later. But again, we're all a bunch of volunteers here, so it takes time, but we'll get there. So please be patient. Make peace, be kind, be gentle, as the path of those who are Buddhists and living under the five precepts. And I will now give a blessing for you all. And not only for those who have just taken the three refuges and the five precepts, but for all those others who have made this event possibly today, event possible today. All the AV, which means audio visual team, all the cleaners, all the people who have decorated the shrine, all the hard work which people put into this place out of love for the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, and out of service to each one of you. Here's the blessing. Sabbaroga Vinimuto Sabba Santa Pavajito Sabba Viramati Gando Nibuto Chatu Wangbawa Sabitiyo vivacantu sabarogo vinasatu mate bhavantarayo sukhidigayu gopava Apivadana silitsa nicha Uttapachalino Chattaro dhamma vatanti Ayuvano sukhang As the last four words, Ayuvano Sukhang Balam, may you have long life, may you have a beautiful life, happiness and strength. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Oh, so there we go, that's finishing off the Waysack live streaming for 2020. Thank you again for all the audio official work, all the good work from Dennis, all the good work from everybody here. Thank you. Oh, and now I'll turn the voice off. I've got one signature to add.